Wes Montgomery music to get you in the mood for talking about wine on the show today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Great to have back Rob Lewis. He is owner, winemaker, and sommelier for Lewis Station Winery in Lake Mills, and also Stable Rock Winery and Distillery in Jefferson. And we're going to talk with him about different wine growing regions, what to expect from different grapes. We'll also talk about sparkling wine for your New Year's Eve celebration. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Maybe you've got a good wine or sparkling wine story to tell us. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Rob Lewis, good to have you back.
Oh, it's great to be here, Larry.
This has been a difficult year for most retailers. How's it been going for you and other winemakers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I appreciate the question. And first, I want to say the music that you played, it really made me want to open a bottle of wine. So that was a great introduction. That was some great music to start with.
Yeah, Wes Montgomery, it's a perfect music.
It is perfect music. This year, you know, as everybody knows, it's kind of been a challenging year, and for Wisconsin wineries, it really hasn't been. It's been challenging for us as well. I mean, our industry is built on tourism, and with a lack of people, you know, going out and visiting wineries, it's kind of been a challenge. Although what I do know, and I've been pretty active with the Winery Association and a lot of my fellow members here in the state, that we have a significant pledge to practice COVID safety practices and protocol.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can tell you that most wineries are open for business. A lot of wineries have indoor capacity that we've set up, and you know, we've set up routines for picking up and even doing local deliveries. So, you know, Wisconsin wineries, we're open, and we've got five beautiful regions in our state producing incredible blueberry and cranberry and apple wines and Petite Pearl and Sauvignon Blanc and all kinds of things. So if somebody wants to, over the holiday, pick up an incredible Wisconsin wine, that would be great, because I can tell you the wineries here in the state would love to see you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, one of the things that was always fun about stopping at Lewis Station Winery or some of the other wineries was the chance to do some tastings. How has wine tasting changed?
You know, that's a great question. So I early on, it was a decision that was made by most winery owners, and that was to no longer do your typical tasting where you come up to your tasting bar, and because, you know, a lot of people stand around close together at the tasting bar, and that's not the best way to handle safety. So what most wineries had done is we created this tasting flight. So you would come up, you know, to the bar, and you get possibly a menu, and you would circle the wines that you would like to sample, and the wine staff would then pour into small, like, disposable tasting glasses and allow you to go back to a table that was appropriately separated so that you could still sample wines and learn about those wines and still kind of be in that wine tasting winery environment without standing at the bar with, you know, a lot of other people. So, you know, again, it's one of those adaptions that takes place when you're given a situation, you make the best out of it. And yeah. We had a lot of travelers come and visit the wineries this summer and even now, managing it differently at the wineries. So it's worked out.
And you have a new winery and distillery. Tell us about it.
You know, Larry, I have a knack for opening businesses at the wrong time. It's funny, I opened Lewis Station in 2008, and of course that's, you know, we had a slight depression then, and then we bought the building in 2019 and started working on the building, and then COVID happened, and we still opened the business, again, not to the same fanfare as you possibly would without COVID-19, but it's been going well. We opened about 6 months ago, and the winery is doing very well. It's a very large building, so we have two large floors that we have probably about 8,000 square feet. So there's plenty of room indoors for people to come in. We have everything spaced out so you can enjoy some of the wines that we have over at Stable Rock, as well as we opened a distillery there too. So we're purchasing distilled spirits and aging them and barrel aging them at the winery and distillery there. And we've released a vodka and a bourbon as well as a rye whiskey. So it's, you know what? All things considering, it's doing okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when it comes to making wine, what are the top countries? Let's talk about this. The top countries or regions, and what are the characteristics of the wine made there? Let's just get some basics here.
You got it. I'll give you some basic information. As I was doing a little research, just looking at my notes from things that I've sampled over the years, there are a lot of countries and a lot of great wines out there. So it's kind of tricky to narrow it down to specific things, but I kind of did, you know, here's the top region and here's the wine to look for. So this is kind of the wine that this region or this country is really known for. So that way, you know, when you go to your favorite liquor store, grocery store, or you're shopping online, you know that you're going to get a really great value wine that represents that region. So first, one of my favorite, I'm a huge Italian wine fan, and like a lot of the wines that I produce have Italian background. So my favorite wine of all time is a Barolo. Now, Barolo is an Italian, actually, so Barolo is actually a village in northwestern Italy, but it's made with the Nebbiolo grape. And Barolo is kind of known as the king of Italian wine because it is big, it's bold, it's spicy, it's rich, it's powerful. And it's named after a small village about the size of Lake Mills, actually. So it's not real big, right? So a true Barolo from that area, you know, they're more expensive. You know, you can get them between $200 and $400. So they're really expensive because they're very exclusive. But there are Barolo producers out there like Rivada where you can get a great tasting Barolo for $20 to $30. And again, that's made with the Nebbiolo grape, which is also with Barbaresco and some other lighter varietals. But that Nebbiolo grape is very universal. And then when you think about Italy, it's hard to not think about Chianti.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, just the whole Tuscan village, you know, the whole Tuscan area driving through the countryside. And I have to say I'm very disappointed because my wife and I were supposed to go to Tuscany this past March, and we had to cancel the trip. So what we did is we found a video on Culinary Travels. It's a PBS show with Dave Eckert, and it really detailed very specific regions in Chianti and and traveling through Tuscany. And my wife and I picked up a great bottle of Chianti and just kind of immersed ourselves as if we were there. I mean, we weren't there, but, you know, it felt like we were there, right? So for Italy, Barolo, Sangiovese, which is the Chianti, it's really hard to go wrong there.
Well, now, close by, you've got Spain.
Close by, we've got Spain. A lot of influences, Italian winemakers moving to Spain, you know, certainly from France, too. But Spain, we have Sherry, so Jerez Valley, which is Jerez, which is actually a village, the southwest, right on the ocean there. That's where Sherry is made, and Sherry is an oxidized white wine, you know, Sherry, it's rich and creamy and velvety and generally a little higher in alcohol, which is not a bad thing. Rioja, though. Rioja is probably one of my favorite wines, certainly in Spain. And the predominant grape in Rioja is Tempranillo. And Tempranillo is a red grape that actually originates in France, but Tempranillo, you can find bottles from like $10 to $30. I mean, it's a great value wine. some Tempranillos that are a little more expensive. They're reservas, and they've been aged in barrels for 3 years and then aged in bottles for 2 years and then released after 5 years. So there's a lot of investment in that, and so those wines might be a little more expensive. But, boy, can you taste the quality. I mean, if you think of something like the biggest, richest Cabernets that you can think of, that's what you can get from a Tempranillo from Rioja in Spain. So it's pretty amazing, great values coming out of Rioja in Spain. So it's hard to overlook Spain. It's pretty amazing. And then let's see. Let's go to Australia. Am I going too fast?
No, that's good. Oh, great. Okay. I love this trip around the world.
Yeah, we're taking it. You know, most people didn't get to travel the world, you know, in 2020. So travel the world in a bottle of wine, you know, that's a great way to do it. So Australia, you know, probably the most prominent grape varietal coming out of Australia isn't Australian. It's French, but Australian, it's called Shiraz. So Shiraz or Shiraz, you know, I've heard it both references, but technically that's the Syrah grape that comes out of France. So, you know, late 1800s, it migrates with some grape growers down to Australia, and specifically in the Barossa Valley, you'll find some incredible Shiraz. And one that comes to mind without even doing any research is the Barossa Valley Estate, and that's one of the oldest estates there in the Barossa Valley. Great wines, $15 to $25. You might have an older Reserva that might be $50 or so, but those are readily available, Barossa Valley Estate, and that's a great example of that Shiraz grape varietal. And again, that grape, it's big, it's complex, it's inky. When you drink it, you know, you'll get almost hints of tobacco. And after you swallow the wine, 5 minutes later, you still taste it. So that tells you that's a pretty incredible wine. Again, great value when you're looking at a $25 bottle of wine that can do that for you.
You know, as long as we're in Australia, let's just hop over to New Zealand. It's close by.
New Zealand. it is close by. You know, it's surrounded by water. It's kind of a completely different climate altogether. The most widely planted grape in New Zealand is Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc, it's very distinctive in New Zealand. That's one of those unique things about Sauvignon Blanc and about New Zealand, is that you could line up a Sauvignon Blanc from any other country in the world and taste them, and you would be able to identify New Zealand right off the bat. And part of that is that it's very distinctive. It's got a very grassy note to it. It's very flinty. Lots of grapefruit, so in the nose you smell grapefruit, you smell lemongrass. When you taste it, you get hints of gooseberry, and it's so crisp and clean that it completely refreshes your palate and you start to salivate. It's pretty Sauvignon Blanc kind of does that around the world, but I'm telling you, if you get to if you grab a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, it's very distinctive. So if you have, if you know, your listeners have time, I would recommend grab some Sauvignon Blanc, maybe one from France, grab a New Zealand, and grab a California, and try all of them. You'll see that they're all very distinct, but you will definitely notice the difference with the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. In fact, it's by far my wife's favorite wine, and she's been trying to get me to make a New Zealand style Sauvignon Blanc, and I can't do it because we don't live in New Zealand, so it doesn't work. But two great bottles, Whitehaven and Kim Crawford, those are two great names for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. They're very respected wines from that country, and they taste very distinct, and you know, and they're reasonable. They're, you know, $15, $20 bottle of wine, and it tastes like a $50 bottle of wine. So it's something to do.
Rob Lewis, our guest today, having some fun with him talking about wines we're going around the world here a little bit, talking about the wines of the world. That's great fun. He's the owner, winemaker, and sommelier for Lewis Station Winery in Lake Mills and Stable Rock Winery and Distillery in Jefferson. Let's give you a chance to join in, too. Questions about wine. Do you have a favorite that you want to mention? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Talking wine today with Rob Lewis, owner of Lewis Station Winery in Lake Mills and Stable Rock Winery and Distillery in Jefferson. Oh, it's a lot of fun to kind of travel around the world with him. If you have some questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Dale in Stevens Point, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
My question is regarding your guest's stance on aging of wine in the bottle, not in the cask, but in the bottle. I am myself a wine maker. I just put up a nice Chianti. And I know the controversial as to does it age in the bottle, what about white versus red? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. So aging wine in the bottle, does it age?
Well, I'm not going to be able to solve this controversy. How about that? I love being put in the hot seat like that, right? So, the question does... aging in the bottle matter? And for me, I would say the answer would be yes, it does. Things happen, right? So if it's aging in a barrel or aging in your tank, it has more exposure to oxygen, specifically in barrels. So as the wine develops and ages with that exposure, that kind of creates complexity in the wine. Now, once it hits the bottle and you bottle it, you're cut off from oxygen, essentially. Now, some corks may allow over extended periods of time some oxidation, but it does further develop in the bottle. And, you know, a lot of the, going through school, learning through this, and I've experienced this, and I'll kind of tell you a story about it, too, is that it does develop an age in the bottle as well. And that's sometimes where you kind of get the bouquet of the wine is developed actually in the bottle, at least from my perception of this. I mean, you can get a lot of great aromas and flavors and things by aging, you know, in barrels and so forth. But once you get in the bottle and it ages in the bottle, it does continue to develop. And then over an extended period of time, then it starts to slowly decline because wine is kind of a living and breathing thing too. So my example, here's my example, and that is I made a wine a few years ago, and I aged it in tequila barrels. So I had a Cabernet aged in tequila barrels. Once I decided to bottle it, pulled it out of the tequila barrel, put it in my tank, and moved it to bottles, at that time, I thought it was over the top for me. And now we had a lot of fans that love that wine because they love our bourbon barrel wine. The tequila barrel wine for me, I thought when I bottled it, I'm like, you know what? If I have a disappointment that I put in the bottle, this would be the one. And at that point, I even said, I'm not doing tequila barrels anymore because I assumed it was a tequila barrel that did it. It obviously couldn't have been my fault, right? So it was the barrel's fault. But over the last 2 or 3 years, now that I open that, it's actually quite delicious. The aromas, the flavors, everything has kind of come into maturity for me. And the only way that that happened was that I left it in the bottle for 3 years, right? So for me, I would say, you know, it can be controversial, but I think aging it makes a difference. And again, it's not just aging it's how you age it. So it's, you know, it's not putting it next to a heater or putting it in a wine rack on top of your fridge. That's bad, you know. Here in Wisconsin, we've got great basements with great cellars because you don't have to do anything. It's just natural being in our climate to have a great basement that could be a great cellar. So assuming you age wine, put it downstairs. Don't put it next to a heat vent or next to a window where it gets hot and cold all the time. it'll further develop in the bottle. And the best way to know that is to sample it. So every few months, grab another bottle, uncork it, and taste it. And that's how you'll know.
Jill Nadeau shot me a note. She said, I like that wine. It's yummy.
I've had so many people say, no, you can't not make it. And I'm like, I'll probably end up making it again, of course. But, but my stance at the time was no way, because it didn't fit with what I wanted. But, boy, did it develop in the bottle.
Well, Rob Lewis, our guest, questions or comments or experiences to share about wine, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. You know, the last we talked, we were in New Zealand when we were talking about wines of the world.
Yeah.
What do you say we hop in a plane and fly over to Germany and find out what's over there?
Wow, so Germany, they've been making wine for a really long time, right? So it's really hard to go, here's the German wine, right? But there are a couple wines. One, most people will think about, they think about Riesling. And yes, Riesling, that is one of the largest crops, grape crops in Germany. They go anywhere from bone dry to an ice wine, which is a dessert wine, which is a sweet wine. So there's lots of options, all from that same grape varietal. So you can get, an ice wine, which is it's rich and flavorful, and it's kind of a thicker wine. It's usually 12 to 14% alcohol, sometimes, considerably higher. It's a creamy butterscotch. But then you have your classic Riesling, which is crisp, dry, but flavorful with hints of green apple. Those are all amazing. Amazing white. Dr. Lucen is an old vineyard there that produces wines anywhere from $10 to $70 bottles, so you get a wide range. But something that is kind of fun, and you have to do maybe a little research when you go to your liquor store to find it, but like Total Wines, and there are places that kind of specialize in this kind of stuff, you'll find a wine called Spätburgunder. So Spätburgunder is a light red wine, and it's actually Pinot Noir. So kind of fun is, grab your, here I'm all about doing like vertical tasting. So you grab a great Pinot Noir from California or Washington State, grab a Pinot Noir, obviously a Burgundy from France, and then find a Spätburgunder from Germany and line all three of them up and try it. You'll be amazed at what climate or terroir, which is everything that kind of Mother Earth brings to that grapevine. It's kind of amazing to see how that influences the actual grape itself. So that's three different countries, three different wines, same grape, all delicious. So there you go.
You mentioned France is one of them, and Tom in Milwaukee emailed that he found a new favorite a few years ago when he was in Paris. Viognier, a wonderful, crisp, light-bodied wine, mostly from the Rhone Valley, but he believes it's cultivated in other countries as well.
Yes. Viognier. That's how I remember how to say it. I actually have to spell out yay at the end, so Viognier. So Viognier, yes. It's a French varietal, although it is cultivated everywhere. And Viognier, it can be sweet to dry. Generally, Viognier is a little bit sweeter, unless it comes from, like, California, some of the hotter climates. In those cases, it's usually going to be a little bit drier and a little bit higher in alcohol. But they, they range anywhere from 10 to 14% alcohol. Very floral. So that's kind of a characteristic of Viognier. It's actually one of my favorite wines, too. It's a easy drinking wine. You can pretty much find it anywhere, and most wine producing countries do make a Viognier. And it's so how to spell it. So if somebody's going to research it, Viognier, Viognier.
Ah, Viognier. Okay. Well, now I've got the pronunciation down. Well, let's stay in France for a minute because when I think about France, champagne comes to mind too.
Yes, so champagne, obviously, up near the Paris, so colder climate up there. Champagne is a region, so it's not actually a grape varietal. You know, sometimes that surprises people. But the actual grape that's used for champagne, there are three, but the two most common is Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, they're both cold climate varietals, so that's why you find them in northern France and you find them in Germany, because they survive the cold climate, but not quite the Wisconsin cold climate yet. But I know there's research into that right now. But so champagne, you know, some people think it's just for celebration, but champagne is a wine that you can drink all the time. Champagne is it's very food friendly. I mean, you obviously can have oysters and mussels with it.
Yeah.
You can have it with barbecued spiced ribs. Champagne is that versatile, and part of that is because, one, it's flavorful, it's got some fruit to it, but it's got that crispy zest to it, which complements seafood perfectly, but it also is the contrast to spicy ribs. So it's one of those complex wines that's been around for centuries, that's not just for celebration. So I encourage people to grab a champagne, but if you're in France, there are two other regions you have to go to. And this is kind of the mother country, so almost all of the varietals that you find around the world its classification is Vitis vinifera. Most of them are from France. So when I say mother country, I mean that's kind of where a lot of these grape varietals started, and Burgundy and Bordeaux are another classic examples. Burgundy, that's your Pinot Noir. That is your Chardonnay and your Gamay. So those are typical wines that you find are the wines that are produced in Burgundy, including Beaujolais, which is kind of right there close to Burgundy. Sometimes there can be really expensive, but you can find some really good Burgundian wines too, like Louis Latour. That's a great Burgundian wine that's reasonable. It's $20-$25, and you can really taste what Burgundy is really about. Bordeaux is the big brother of Burgundy, if you will, right? So Bordeaux, closer to the ocean, a little bit, it's a little bit cooler, actually, but Bordeaux is a region. It's not a grape varietal. Bordeaux, that's where you're going to find Cabernet. That's, you know, that's the home of Cabernet Sauvignon. That's the home of Merlot, Malbec, Cabernet Franc, and Petit Verdot. Those are the five varietals that can make up actually a Bordeaux. So Bordeaux is about blends. And then Bordeaux, you have what's called the left bank and the right bank, because you've got, the Rhine? I have a picture in my head, but I can't think of the name right now. But I think that's the river that separates the left bank and the right bank. The right bank would be more Merlot based, whereas the left bank, Cabernet grows exceptionally well. But those are the five varietals that you typically find in a Bordeaux. And Bordeaux, you can get anywhere from inexpensive Bordeaux are still good Bordeaux at about $8, but some of the most expensive wines in the world, being $2,000-$5,000 a bottle, you'll find that they'll probably be Bordeaux. So it all depends on what your budget is. So next time you go to your liquor store, look at their Bordeaux. They probably have an aisle of 5,000 wines to choose from, and the price is from 1 to 5,000. So
there you go.
Well, good luck with Bordeaux. But you know what? They're all delicious. So.
Cal in Sugar Camp has something relating to French wines, I believe. Let's go there. Cal, hi.
Hi. Many, many years ago, I had this fabulous wine. I think it was a Jadot brand, but I'm not sure that's a good memory. But it was Pouilly Fossé, and it was heavenly. Speak to me of Pouilly Fossé.
Oh, boy, you're going to put me right on the spot like that, aren't you? So Pouilly Fossé, I believe that is actually Burgundian. Boy, that's about all I got. You know, I know I have a bottle of, like, Louis Latour, so I know that Louis Latour has a Pouilly Foussé, and that's kind of the region. So it's a very specific region in France. And I believe it's pretty close. It's just outside of Burgundy, if I'm not mistaken. So that's generally going to be, like, your Chardonnay and your Pinot Noir. Now, maybe somebody can call and give me some clarification on that, but as my memory serves, I believe that is where you're going to find Pouilly Foussé. But you know what? Very delicious, velvety. I remember it being, like, very floral but very rich. Very memorable, apparently, because you remember it. So that's the exciting thing about wine is, boy, you can anchor an incredible memory to something, you know, to a wine that you've had, and that's pretty special.
Yeah. Cal, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Back to champagne for a minute. What's the difference between, like, a sparkling wine and champagne? Somebody wanted to know that.
Yeah, Larry, you know, that's a great question. So there are different types of, well, so there's different types of sparkling wine. That's probably the best way to say it. And because champagne is a sparkling wine. But all sparkling wines are not champagne. So champagne, if it has champagne on the label, it comes from the region of Champagne in France. And that's made in the traditional method of how they've made champagne for hundreds of years. Now, there are different ways to make champagne. There are different ways to make sparkling wine. And that's where sparkling wine is. Sparkling is its effervescence. So it's CO2 that still remains in the wine. So champagne, it's the original CO2 from fermentation or possibly the secondary fermentation where it starts to re-ferment in the bottle and it creates that CO2 that makes it sparkling in the wine itself. Whereas in, like, other regions, let's say, like, Asti Spumante or, like, Italy or maybe in Spain with Cava, those are sparkling wines. Some are made in the traditional method, and you'll see that detailed on the bottle. But usually your lesser expensive sparkling wines, like some of your inexpensive Asti Spumantes and things, those are not made in the traditional method. Those are made where they inject CO2. So with a still wine that's made, they inject CO2. They make it sparkling, and then they bottle it compressed in a thicker bottle with the, you know, the cage on top to make sure it doesn't, you know, pop off during shipment or sitting on your wine rack. And there are different levels of quality, but there are different ways to make it. So if you find even a cava that says, you know, made in traditional method, or method traditionnel, I think is actually what it says on the label. It's usually going to be a little more expensive because there's a lot more time involved in the development of that. But as a result, it's going to taste richer and thicker because, you know, it's not a still wine where you're injecting CO2. But you know what? They're all delicious. So it's one of those things. You know, it's, you know, like, you know, like I said earlier, people think sparkling wine, you think that's celebration. No, that's every day that you wake up, it's a celebration, right? So open a bottle of champagne. No, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm thinking ahead here. What is it? 8 or 9 days from now, we'll be at New Year's Eve.
Yes, we will.
And we'll be celebrating in much smaller groups this year. But can we still share a good wine over Zoom or another app? What do you have for suggestions for sparkling wines, let's say, that friends and family from all over can share?
Yeah, that's a great question. So absolutely, you can still have your celebration for New Year's Eve, but, you know, you're probably doing it via Zoom, which is kind of fun. My wife and I, we've done this with quite a few friends already. So can you celebrate over New Year's Eve? Absolutely. There are some, I can make some suggestions on wines that I know, regardless of where your friends are and you're celebrating, chances are you're going to find this wine, and it's reasonably priced. You know, you got Martini and Rossi. It's $5 to $25. You can find it at your local grocery store. So that's something that, you know, if you connect with your friends early enough, hey, go out and get this Martini Rossi and grab some oysters and whatever, right? And then you kind of have your celebration. Moscato d'Asti or Prosecco, those are Italian varietals that are sparkling. Rivada is a big name that you'll find pretty much anywhere. And again, reasonable, starting $10, $15. You can get vintage bottles of those, which might be $30 to $40. But again, it's a celebration. It's New Year's Eve, so it's okay. And then Moët Chandon, $15 to $25. You can find those anywhere, too. A great cava, so that's a Spanish version. You know, I'm a huge fan of cava. I'm thinking that I don't drink it enough. There's what's the name of it? It's Alicia. I think it's like E-L-Y-S-S-I-A. I should look that up real quick. But I think it's Alicia. Makes an incredible cava, and it's almost like a rosé because it's made out of Pinot Noir, and you actually see a hint of the pink color. I believe that one's Brut, so it's a touch drier. But it is so clean and crisp, and it tastes like dried strawberries. I mean, it's and it's. I remember it being like $18 or $20 bottle, something like that. But that, I mean, if you're looking for something unique and special that you want to share, you know, to try to find that Pinot Noir cava might be something fun to do.
Dwayne in Wausau has a question for you. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, hi. Great topic, especially this time of year. I had the chance to do demo a lot of wines, you know, and you'd have three or four reds out. And I told people that if you ever buy a bottle of wine that you can't taste first, and it's not like one of your favorites, you know, serve some great, like, Asiago cheese. And I played that trick on my wife. I said, oh, you got to try this wine. It's really good. And it was just like $10. But I said, but try this cheese first and then try the wine. And she goes, oh, this wine's great. And, you know, the hors d'oeuvres really helped. And then, of course, having it at a, not having it too warm on the red, you know, the right temperature, I think, is a lot, you know, either white or red. And then I made chicken marsala, and I tasted the marsala wine by itself, you know, easy for cooking, but it reminded me when I was an altar boy, we would take a little bit of the altar wine before service. It just reminded me of that.
Oh, that's funny.
A good story. Well, so something like cheese. Sometimes if you got a wine you don't like, maybe the cheese will help it out.
You know, boy, Dwayne shared a lot of great things right there, you know? And that's one of those things that winemakers and, you know, being a sommelier, that's kind of where my training is. And, you know, I've done classes on this too. And that is pairing the wine with food is amazing. And as he, you know, explained with his wife, you know, it's an inexpensive bottle of wine, and maybe it wasn't even good, but if you have a piece of cheese and now you're coating your mouth with fat, and now you drink a wine that's really dry, you don't taste all the tannic structure of that dry wine anymore. All you do is what happens is you taste the fruit of the wine. So that's what's amazing about food and wine pairing is that, I mean, you can line up, like you said, your wines and sample your wines, but as soon as you start to interject food, cheese especially, something high in fat, it really changes the chemical structure on your palate on how you perceive that wine. And the other thing that does that is something that's salty. So, I mean, if you're having something salty, salty negates acidity. So if you're having, I can't even think of an example right now, but if you're having something olives. So olives are very salty. Try having an olive with champagne, because champagne is very acidic. Have it with an olive, your champagne will completely change. It won't even taste the same, and it's because you had salt. It's because salt negates acidity, so they kind of balance each other out, so you can actually really taste the champagne. So it's one of those things, you know, what I'd encourage people, and this would be a great New Year's Eve party with your friends on Zoom, grab some cheese, grab some, like, Italian salami, so some meat, grab, you know, like almonds or walnuts. That would be awesome. Something salty, right? So so the olives, the green or black olives, you line that up. So you're having sweet, salty, you know, bitter, you're doing that, have that with your wine and just experiment with your friends with the wines and how the wines change the food, because that is an amazing experience. So I'm glad he had that. And he talked about Marsala. Marsala, excellent wine. A lot of people think it's just for cooking. It's not really just for cooking. It's fortified with brandy or some neutral grain, grape spirit. So it's for drinking too, but generally speaking, what you cook with, you should be able to drink with too.
Rob, it's always a pleasure. I tell you, we didn't get all the way around the world, so
no, we didn't.
Next time you're on, we'll have to start our journey up again.
Okay, that sounds awesome, Larry.
Rob, thank you so much. Rob Lewis, a winemaker, sommelier. Look up Lewis Station Winery in Lake Mills, or look up Stable Rock Winery and Distillery in Jefferson. Those are his two wineries, and always great to talk with him. You know, he's talking about food and wine. Well, what's better than bread and wine, too? And that's coming up next. I'll tell you how to bake some bread, maybe for New Year's. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.